You're listening to I Have No Process. I am your host, Nicholas England. The brief episode you are about to hear is standalone. Nothing complex about it. This podcast is primarily composed of seasonal arcs, but every once in a while, I'd like to toss out an appetizer when we're on hiatus. I can assure you, Bryce and I have been hard at work getting the next couple of seasons ready for you. Till then, sit back and enjoy something old and something new. There's a man named Sean, I won't trouble him with the mention of a last name, who's had a small but notable impact on my creative development. Sean and I met in the library of our middle school when I was 11 years old. He asked to borrow a pencil from me, and I obliged him my spare. 15 years later, I stood as his best man. I still wonder if I'll ever get that pencil back someday. When I began writing poetry and short stories in my early 20s, I'd frequently go to my friends in order to solicit their requests. I needed practice experimenting with different forms. I didn't care what I was actually writing about, so I figured I might as well delight my comrades in the process. I wrote my friend Carolyn a fable about a dancing unicorn, then wrote her future husband a mystery about an evil bowling alley. Then for her sister, I developed a choose-your-own-adventure story where each strand is stylized in the vein of the author its plotline emulates. But Sean was the first person I approached in this manner. Of all the people in the world, I chose him for my original commission. When I asked him what I ought to do, the man didn't miss a beat. Write a story about a guy with no penis. That's it? Guy with no penis? Yeah, guy with no penis. I determined the premise instantly. I mean, within 10 seconds, I knew the guy. The guy with no penis. I knew his apartment. I knew his shoes. I knew how he got that way. And I knew what his fate would be. So I sat down and wrote my first piece of microfiction. To this day, it is Sean's favorite thing I've written. Some Idle Sap. Terence Loden had successfully avoided a physician slab for over 20 years, but the enduring pain in his guts had crippled him to that very desperate point. When examined unclothed, the doctor's first professional observation was that Terence had no penis. Though obvious in that naked circumstance, no person outside Terence himself had ever known of his want. Until that seminal elucidation. He was certainly born with a fine penis, its craftsmanship regular. He had used it for all of its intended purposes in his youth, micturating and ejaculating on every neighborhood bush. He had washed and kept it with the same care as every other extremity and orifice that belonged to him. Yet despite this normality, a long spell of abstinence, which had occurred during his 27th year, strangely culminated with his penis shrinking and ultimately vanishing from his person. All that remained was a soft, round blotch of skin above his testes that lent him the appearance of having once been burned there, forever almost healed. The conclusion of the mystery surrounding the pain in Terence's stomach was that he had cancer and that death was imminent. He was quickly moved to a nearby hospital, barraged with fruitless tests, strung up to machines like a fleshy puppet, and left to waste in oppressive comfort. Weeks later, very near the end, a beautiful young nurse was appointed his care and performed her tasks with such extraordinary grace that deranged Terence soon fell for her. He thought it was love, but it was not love. She felt a generous amount of sympathy for him, sensing how close his exit, and was not offended by his wild and often vulgar commands. Despite her composure, she was moved to another post by the doctor in charge, a stoic man with a broken thumb whom Terence abhorred. The nurse had been with Terence for 3 days. When told he would never see her again, Terence attempted a daring escape from his hospital bed and had made it as far as the next hallway over when he was finally restrained and returned. He would not cease shouting some female name, what he must have thought was hers, until enough morphine was administered to submit him to rest. These days, it isn't friends and family members who serve me proposals for literary projects, but rather magazines and other more formal literary establishments. This season's fellowship, next season's award. Not that they send the proposals to me exclusively, you know, but I get the newsletters the same as any working poet. Here in Seattle, no organization has provided me with as much fellowship and encouragement as has Hugo House over in Cap Hill. The small sample of writers who frequent that space easily help elucidate why Seattle was named a UNESCO World Literature City back in 2017. The local talent here is extraordinary. Memoirists, young and old, male, female, and otherwise, Black, Indigenous, Latin, Asian, white, sci-fi adventurers and Bukowski-esque slice-of-lifers, as capable of crafting sharp-toothed satire as they are exquisite and heart-rending sincerity. They regularly astonish me. And they are just one cohort out of many in this town. I tell you true, any old Seattleite Josephine is liable to have an unforgettable poem about tomatoes hidden within her satchel. This past year, Hugo House put out a chapbook of their own, a sweet little collection called Coming Home. They asked us to write about what home and community mean to us. And so, for the first time since moving into our new home, I wrote a piece of literature for someone other than myself. and with their customary generosity, they accepted it into the collection. My first piece published for the city of Seattle. Daylight. Rats in the attic. Termites on the porch. Roses spray-painted ultra-white. Spruces strangled by Himalayan black. Bowed walls and buried trash. Spiderweb floors sagging to find a kiss of daylight. Turnkey, they called it, as they froze our inheritance. Now face death by 1,000 home repairs, or surrender all equity. A HELOC for a DADU. Spam risk and cash offers. The market is hot. Don't live, sell. I made eggplant bulgogi for dinner tonight. What color would you like to paint the nursery? You may have noticed that the music this episode was of a different character than the score that accompanied our inaugural season. Indeed, Lisa and Eric of the Rooftop Revival did not write or perform the pieces you just heard, for those were arranged by a composer named Tim McNally, an old friend currently based out of Los Angeles. Tim has signed on not only to write the score for our second season, due out later this spring, but he has also granted us a license to his personal repertoire, which we'll be harvesting whenever these standalone episodes crop up. This doesn't spell a certain end for our collaboration with Lisa or Eric. We remain in discussions with them about reuniting in the future. For now, we're handing the sonic palette over to Tim, and we're as grateful as we are excited to see what he decides to conjure for No Voice. Till then.